listening to Popaganda, a Bitch radio podcast. This episode was recorded on Thursday, December 1st at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, Oregon. Bitch Media is a nonprofit organization, and we rely on your support. Please visit bitchmedia.org/donate to find out how you can get more involved. Just a warning, the following podcast contains explicit language, including the word bitch, of course. It also includes holiday music and talk of penises. Thanks for listening. All right, welcome back to another episode of Bitch Popaganda. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me today are...
I'm Sherston Johnson, the web content manager and senior editor.
And I'm Andy Zeisler, the editorial director.
Today we're going to talk about the sister bloggers article on Good and why so many lifestyle bloggers happen to be Mormon. We're also going to talk about Siri, the iPhone 4S concierge, who is maybe sexist. And then we're going to talk about Katie Royce's article on Slate, Has the Internet Unleashed New Levels of Bile? So...
I'm already laughing about that.
Right. Spoiler alert. Maybe. From us. Okay, so we're going to start by talking about the sister bloggers, why so many lifestyle bloggers happen to be Mormon article by Nona Willis Aronowitz in this issue of Good. And in the article, she profiles several lifestyle bloggers, Mormon women who have short kind of journaly blogs with a lot of photos about things that are happening in their lives, and then posits, you know, some reasons why these bloggers who get a lot of followers, who are popular in the lifestyle blogging community, a high percentage of them are Mormon women. So, first of all, I mean, let's just kind of try to answer the question that she poses in the title. You know, why do you think so many lifestyle bloggers happen to be Mormon?
Well, so I like lifestyle blogs a lot, and I've been reading them for several years, and I actually noticed that some of the ones I read a lot tended to be by Mormons, and I just thought it was a weird coincidence, but actually one of those bloggers wrote a piece about it, and the blog's called Design Mom, and the woman, Gabrielle, asked the question herself, and she said, why are there so many of us? And she posited a few things, one of which was that there's a real strong Mormon tradition of chronicling your life. A lot of Mormon families grow up journaling every day about what they did, and so blogs are kind of a natural extension of that. She also had a pretty funny explanation, which is that apparently Brigham Young University has a really great graphic design program that like sends their graduates out all over the country to these, you know, very well-placed internships that often lead to jobs, and so a lot of people in the design community have these connections through BYU, which, you know, it makes some sense.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the Mormon belief system prides, sort of assigns a lot of pride to homemaking, and a lot of women who are Mormon don't work outside the home, and so I think, simply put, they have the time to blog the way maybe women who have full-time jobs don't.
And also, I was kind of surprised to learn that the median income for Mormon families in the U.S. is much higher than for just kind of the U.S. as a whole, and that they tend to, even with that higher number, be single-income families, which means, you know, one parent, probably the mom with most of these lifestyle blogs, is at home. So, yeah, has more time and more money. I mean, I think part of what makes a lifestyle blog popular is that it's this sort of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, lifestyle porn, where it's like cute kids and fun accessories and fun trips and beautiful photos, and that takes money for the most part. I mean, I don't know of many lifestyle bloggers who talk about struggling with money or have photos of like a messy house and, you know, food from the grocery outlet.
Right, and that's what my
lifestyle blog.
Yeah.
Except for Sherston's Tumblr, where she has photos of what's on her bed.
I actually do take pictures of my messy bed. I'm not Mormon.
So if you want a real gritty, down-to-the-bone lifestyle blog,
check out Sherston's Tumblr.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think that, and that's sort of the thing about lifestyle blogs. And I should say, we have a piece on the sort of representational ideal of women and lifestyle blogs in the next issue of Bitch, the one that's going to be coming out in the spring. And, you know, without stepping on that piece too much, I think, you know, the idea of presenting this really idealized slice of your life is part of lifestyle blogging, you know? I mean, people clean up the corner of their house that they're going to photograph. They're not necessarily, you know, showing you the, like, dirt in their tile grout. I don't think an emphasis on, you know, really showing the best side of yourself is specific to Mormon lifestyle bloggers. But I, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to the effort you put into sort of curating a life that you want to show. And what it comes down to is a lot of these women just have more time.
I think, I thought it was interesting to read, because I went to a high school that had a lot of Mormons. So my experience, I'm not Mormon, but my experience growing up with Mormon friends is anecdotal, but I have some. Kind of interesting the way that they're talking about, you know, how open some of these bloggers are about being Mormon versus not. And I think, you know, she was interviewing Natalie, who was talking about how for a while she was kind of tight-lipped about being Mormon because she was made fun of being Mormon in high school. And I think there are kind of stigma that kind of go with being Mormon as a kid or as a mom. And then she decided after a couple of other things happened online to sort of come out and say, hey, I'm Mormon. We don't have horns. We're not weirdos. Like, you were probably already reading this blog anyway. Surprise, I'm a Mormon blogger. I thought that was kind of interesting because I think my assumption, just kind of looking at the headline of the article, was like, oh, it's Mormons reading these blogs. Like, this is a sort of Mormon network of bloggers. But I think for some of the women who write these blogs, you know, it's not about Mormonism. In fact, they're kind of, I don't want to say hiding the fact that they're Mormon, but it's kind of, you know, they're a lifestyle blogger who's Mormon. It's not a Mormon lifestyle blog.
Yeah, it was interesting in the article when Natalie, I think it was Natalie, received so much pushback when she blogged specifically about religion and Mormonism, where people were upset that, like, that was getting into their feed when they just wanted to hear about, like, chairs and stuff.
Well, yeah, so I guess the question is, like, you know, I thought this was a really fascinating article, but should it matter?
Right.
And I think that brings up, there was a bit of a kerfuffle in the comments section of this article because it was revealed that one of the women interviewed had kind of misrepresented her stance on Proposition 8 in California, which many of you probably know was very well funded by the Mormon Church. And so this blogger, Jordan Fernie, was quoted in the article saying, you know, saying that her Mormon church was very liberal and that a lot of the protesters, the people who were protesting outside her church because of the Mormon support for Prop 8 really had the wrong idea about them. But it's also revealed in the comments that she herself donated to Propositions 8, to fund Proposition 8. And so, you know, I think that brings up the question of, like, should it matter what the political leanings of bloggers whose blogs have nothing to do with politics? Does that matter?
Right. I mean, you know, she's blogging about design or about, like, a trip to the zoo with her kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we care that she supported Prop 8? But, you know, she's making money from the blog. Like, maybe you don't want to support it. I think I noticed also in the comments, and I'm trying to figure out a way to say this without, like, bringing up too many stereotypes about Mormons, because I know that they aren't true. Like, they're stereotypes, not realities. But I think a stereotype about Mormons is that they're, you know, really sunny and positive. And, you know, they mention in the article, like, oh, the blonde, happy woman, she's so easy to hate on because it's this sort of, you know, positivity at all costs attitude. I think maybe because of the prevalence of Mormon lifestyle bloggers, or maybe just because of what lifestyle blogs represent, I feel like the sort of snark that Mormons draw from people is the same sort of snark that lifestyle bloggers draw, where it's like, I thought it was sort of an interesting, like, 1-2 punch of, like, I'm snarking on you because I think of Mormons as being this way, or, like, I'm snarking on you because of you're a lifestyle blogger. Like, I don't know exactly what I'm getting at, except are these two groups that people love to hate, and this is like the Venn diagram where they're together.
It's a deadly combination.
Yeah.
Because I think one of Nona's points was to, well, I don't know if this was her point, but to be like, you think that Mormons are have long hair and their sister wives and they wear ankle-length dresses, but really they're like cool hip mom bloggers. And then you get the flip side where it's like, well, yeah, but I still think they're annoying or like...
Right, or it's like, I also am annoyed by cool hip mom bloggers. So yeah. It's like, it's sort of a 1-2 punch. Like, I mean, I remember, you know, like my Mormon friends in high school always wanted to do this thing. Like, you know, the non-Mormon kids are like, oh, let's go to a party. Like my friend's older brother is going to like get us beer. And they're like, no, let's go love bombing tonight where we like go to people's houses and like write stuff with... you know, sidewalk chalk on the sidewalk. And it's like, that's a total lifestyle blog idea. Like,
they're proto lifestyle bloggers.
Like, that is totally like cute and photographable and fun and also easy for cynical high schoolers to make fun of, you know? And I feel like that is like the lifestyle blog of like, you know, 1999 after midnight activity. But I thought it was a good piece. I thought it was interesting. to sum up. All right. Well, another thing that people are talking about on the internet this week is Siri, the iPhone 4S concierge, which I think a concierge just means like it's a voice controlled assistant, right? And you can ask questions vocally and get answers back from Siri. I don't have the iPhone 4S, but Sherston does. We're going to try it out here. So do you know, Sherston, can you type to Siri also, or is it just voice controlled?
Can I type questions to you, Siri?
Sorry, I don't understand. Can I type questions to you, Siri?
Okay.
We're not sure.
Does that answer your question?
We don't know. So, it's voice controlled, though. We know that much. And a lot of the coverage of it this week has been that Siri is not at all helpful when it comes to women's reproductive issues. And Siri cannot help you find an abortion clinic. Siri cannot help you... What else?
But it might look up addresses to crisis pregnancy centers that are around you, and it won't find Planned Parenthood unless you ask for Planned Parenthood by name.
But it will find, like, Viagra prescriptions for men.
And
right?
Apparently it doesn't understand the term contraception. Can you ask about contraception?
Siri, what is contraception? She's
checking my sources. I found this for you.
What did you get?
Well, she provided some hard data for me. I have some graphs of I have a histogram, a rank curve about contraception. So what she did was looked up contraceptive prevalence rankings of countries around the world for me, providing graphs and statistics.
But if you were somebody, let's say that you were like a 15-year-old who wanted to know what contraception is, was that helpful at all?
No.
Where can I find contraception?
Where can I find contraception nearby?
Sorry, I don't understand. Where can I find contraception nearby?
Okay, so Siri is not on the contraception train.
So there's been a lot of sort of fun feminist experimentation going on this week with Siri. Amanda Marcotte wrote a piece for Forbes.com about it. Jill on Feminist asked it a number of questions to which Siri had answers that were sort of snarky but also profoundly unhelpful. For instance, Jill asked... pretended to be, you know, someone whose girlfriend was pregnant and said, my girlfriend is pregnant, what do I do? And Siri said, first, do no harm. Jill asked again, and Siri said, always do the right thing. So, not so particularly
Spike
helpful.
Lee fan? I don't know.
Yeah.
Just check out that movie. It's really interesting.
And so, there's been a lot of pushback with people being like, well, whatever, it's in beta. Siri doesn't, you know... It has to do with search term optimization. Siri doesn't know this, blah, blah, blah. Stop making such a big deal about it. But I think what Amanda Marcotte pointed out in her Forbes article was really great. It's not specifically the fact that Siri will, you know, direct you to a crisis pregnancy center instead of Planned Parenthood. It's that the entire concept of Siri really ends up replicating a lot of the institutional sexism that comes up in programming in general. And I think that's sort of the takeaway from this. Not, you know, oh, Siri can't help me find an abortion.
Right, or just like, oh, Siri is anti-choice, or, you know, the company that made Siri is anti-choice. I think it's more like, I have a quote from Apple spokeswoman Natalie Karas, who says, our customers want to use Siri to find out all types of information, but it doesn't always find what you want. It simply means that as we bring Siri from beta to a final product, we find places where we can do better, but the fact that Siri was created and programmed by men in a male-dominated industry means, you know, they thought to add Viagra before the beta version came out, but not mm-hmm. abortion.
Right, and we posted something about this on our Facebook page, and a lot of people said, oh, you're just overreacting, you know, not all, you know, Planned Parenthoods use the term abortion in their material, so obviously the search terms wouldn't be optimized and Siri wouldn't pick that up. Well, most escort services don't use the phrase blowjobs in their advertising, but if you ask Siri where you can get a blowjob, she will give you, like, a list of numerous escort agencies, you know, for a service which is, by the way, illegal,
right.
Which abortion isn't.
We asked a few people on our Twitter feed to help us come up with some questions to ask Siri to see what else Siri does or doesn't know about women's reproductive health and activities. So, is Siri ready?
Yes. Siri, where can I get a pap smear?
She's looking.
Searching for where can I get a pap smear.
Oh, good.
I'm getting some Google results. But nothing that's... Basically, Siri Googled the phrase, where can I get a pap smear, which...
It's not something that you need a concierge's help for.
I guess I have information about it, but that didn't really answer my question.
Well, so ask it something parallel.
Where can I get a colonoscopy?
Sorry, I couldn't find any places matching colonoscopy.
Interesting.
All right, okay. So Siri's not ready for that type of exam. Ask about a doula service, yeah.
Siri, where can I find a doula service?
I found 3 doulas fairly close to you.
Hey, she
really?
Did.
Siri
yeah.
does know about doulas. That's good news.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not as dire as we thought. Ask Siri, say we're a woman looking for sex.
Siri, I'm a woman looking for sex.
Are you?
Yes, I am. Help me out.
I don't know what you mean by, yes, I am.
I'm a woman looking for sex. Can you help me out?
If you say so.
So Siri's not going to help us.
Wah-wah.
Siri's very judgmental. Say, Siri, I would like a penis.
You say that.
I would like a penis.
Oh, Siri is scolding us.
Siri is really tisking us for using that kind of language.
Well, where can I get a blowjob?
Sorry, I couldn't find any escorts.
She apologizes for that, but...
She knows what you mean, because she said escorts.
Yeah.
Try saying just oral sex. Siri, where can I find oral sex?
Didn't find any adult retail stores.
I don't know if you can get oral sex in an adult retail store.
Can you say, Siri, I'm looking for some porn?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's ask for feminist porn.
Siri, I'm looking for feminist porn.
Sorry, I couldn't find any adult retail stores.
By the way, there are adult retail stores.
I was going to say, this is Portland. There's like an adult, there are like 7-Elevens.
We have feminist porn here in the office.
I'm going to ask her.
Maybe ask about regular porn. Though,
if I can find it on the internet. Where can I find feminist porn on the internet?
Searching the web for feminist porn.
Boom.
What did you get? All right, so we got some feminist porn
online.
Yeah,
but I could have typed
you could have done a
Google
search.
Google, so.
Yeah. It's not helping you. I mean, I'm only kind of kidding that there is feminist porn within 100 yards of where we're sitting right now. Siri's not helping us.
I just don't really see the point of Siri to begin with. I mean, I guess it's sort of like
If I didn't want to look you up on my phone, I could.
Yeah, okay.
I think some of it is just like kind of a hands-free, like if you're driving and you really just, it's like basically just functioning as you typing into Google, but Siri will just do it for you. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're trying to move to a place where it's kind of, I mean, you know, using like algorithms, sort of doing some thinking for you so that you can say like, what should I get my dad for his birthday? Right. And like Siri will have collected data enough to be able to make suggestions, which is, you know, could be cool, also could be creepy. Definitely is kind of an invasion of privacy, but you don't have to set Siri up on your phone too, which is
mentioning. I mean, I guess what I found interesting about the coverage of this is that, you know, I don't necessarily think this is something that feminists were really going to rally around as like a real, you know, action item. I just think it became sort of an experiment. Like, what could Siri get you? Mm-hmm. You know, like there was a Raw Story article that we posted on our Facebook that, you know, basically was like, Siri can help you get a hamster out of your rectum. It can help you find a dead body, but it cannot get you an abortion. You know, that's just kind of like sort of absurdist, like situational journalism. But I think the sort of backlash to that is what's been interesting to me. People being like, oh, well, I don't understand why feminists are getting so upset about this. And I think it comes back to the idea that, like, the people who program this are really thinking about a specific audience, and it's definitely not women. And so that's sort of my takeaway from this, is that, you know, the programming community that develops these products is still very male, and as more of these products become part of our daily lives, that's a reflection that we're going to see.
I think it's interesting that they chose a woman to be the concierge, yet clearly didn't have women's issues in mind. I don't know. I would assume there's probably research done that people would prefer to deal with a woman.
Yeah, I think most GPS voices are female as well. Mm-hmm. I think there's this idea of, like, you know, it's kind of this nurturing, non-judgmental voice. Although, as we know, that is not true.
Seriously, you gave me all those drafts about contraception? That was really weird. I'll take a screenshot.
Okay, speaking of other blog-related content, so...
And judgmental women.
And judgmental women. Not Siri, Katie Royfe, has an article up today on Slate called Back Off Angry Commenters. Has the internet unleashed new levels of bile? First of all,
we need some context here.
Okay, Andy, why don't you give us a little Katie Royfe background for new listeners?
Well, okay, so Katie Royfe is a champion loophole woman in the anti-feminist community. She's someone who's so male-identified and so prides herself on being, you know, a woman who is more like men than those other women. She wrote an entire book in the early 90s called The Morning After, whose thesis was basically, I go to Harvard, none of my friends have been date raped, therefore date rape is the figment of the imagination of a lot of hysterical feminists, and we need to all get over it already. She's been plying this kind of contrarian trade for many, many years now. And I think it was a couple of weeks ago she wrote an op-ed in the New York Times about the sexual harassment allegations against Herman Cain, which basically managed to miss the entire point of the Herman Cain sexual harassment allegations. And basically the article was like, wow, what has the workplace become when you can't tell a dirty joke and, you know, women need to just get over it because... What is sex harassment anyway? I have no idea because I literally have never worked in an office. That was basically the article.
So therefore, it doesn't exist.
Yes.
And today, she has discovered the internet and internet commenting. She says, the angry commenter is a new breed, and the study of them also new. And then she says she welcomes further evidence or information. It's like... I'm sorry, this is not new, even at all. If this article came out 15 years ago, then maybe. I just, this idea that it's totally framed as like a newsflash, internet commenters can be kind of nasty. Like, is there something going on online that's making people act rude?
Well, it's also really disingenuous because she has written virtually the same piece before whenever she writes an article that gets a lot of negative blowback. She writes an article about, like, what's up with rudeness on the internet? So I think she's just failed to grasp the point that it actually is her.
Some of this is you. And also she had a lot of totally off-base arguments that were kind of only getting at a little bit of the point. And obviously, I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this issue. So, I mean, maybe there are readers on Slate who are like, huh, I never really thought about comment culture online. But I doubt it. If you're reading the comments on Slate, you've probably...
If you're a regular reader of Slate, I think you're more than aware that internet discourse is not always extremely civil.
Right, and that this is a thing. But, you know, then she goes on to talk about, like, oh, commenters, they love to talk about privilege. She puts it in quotes, like, it's not real. Like, oh, the writers are so privileged. Like, first of all, if you're writing for Slate, you probably are privileged. I think that that, you know, it's a pretty major outlet. Like, I don't... You know, I agree with her that maybe not everybody who writes for Slate is wealthy, but privilege
is
different.
Well, she's also not, but she's, it would be a more tenable argument if she were talking about actual writers other than herself.
Right.
But the entire article is a veiled complaint that people are being mean to Katie Royfe on the internet, and Katie Royfe is absolutely, inarguably, one of the most privileged people writing on the internet.
Well, one thing that I noticed on it is that she uses examples of people who are really snarkily bringing up class and race privilege, and I think she's doing that, that's like a rhetorical method to be like, see how, like, this is so ridiculous about privilege, like, I don't have this many cars, and I see that point, but what it's doing is that by doing that, she's saying, therefore, no, like, anytime you bring up privilege, like, it's... you're just one of, like, the trolls, which isn't true at all, because there are, like, very well thought out race and class critiques.
Yes.
Especially
when it's
for Roy
worth Fee. Calling out. I mean, it's worth saying that, like, you're able to ignore privilege and class issues because you are privileged. Like, some people don't have the luxury to just not think about it or say that it's bullshit.
Well, and furthermore, were she not so privileged, she wouldn't be rewriting the kind of articles that have a point of view that get that kind of blowback. You know, I mean, if she had written the Herman Cain article from the point of view of someone who had really held a lot of office or factory jobs or jobs in which, you know, the interactions are often, you know, in that controversial area of what's a joke and what's sexual harassment. But she's coming from a real ivory tower place. I think this is an interesting conversation in light of some of the things that have been discussed on the internet in the past month about how women really are subject to a lot of harassment on the internet. And I think, unfortunately, this piece really cheapens it by making it all about Katie Royfe.
There's a line where she's like, for some reason it seems to come down harder on women, but I can't put my finger on why that is.
Because she won't acknowledge sexism, so she can't say that it has anything to do with sexism.
Yeah, I mean,
she set herself up.
It's like the biggest piece of irony in the whole piece.
I also noticed, you know, she says something about how writers come under attack, and, like, people have such a problem with writers, as if it's like...
Who else is writing
on the internet? It's not writers aren't getting singled out. Writers are the only people writing on the internet. Like, that's...
It's not like, hi, I build shingles. I'm writing this piece on the internet, but I'm not really a writer.
She went on YouTube and read the comments.
Right.
Yeah,
because
that doesn't
they're
happen.
Getting a lot of vitriol on YouTube also. And then she says, you know, this is like a Mao or a Ho Chi Minh argument, like, against kind of culture makers. And just, like, if Mao or Ho Chi Minh was around now, they'd be angry commenters, too. Like, what? That's just...
Like, do you know what's going on in China right now?
Right, I'm just like, did you read this before you published it? I was really... That's really blowing things out of proportion in my mind. Maybe if they were alive, they would be angry commenters on Slate, but I doubt it.
I'm pretty sure they'd have bigger things to do.
Yeah, I just don't. Sorry, Katie Royfe, they probably wouldn't have even read your article about Herman Cain.
Ho Chi Minh is an interesting...
I think that this would be, as someone who doesn't shy away from saying that I'm a feminist, this is a really difficult argument, because it's like, do I want people to call Katie Royfe out for her, you know, almost cartoonishly biased pieces? Yes, I do. Do I want them to be sexist about it? No, I don't. But she is, you know, she's kind of put her readers, her feminist readers, in a position of, you know, yes, I find all sexism on the internet pretty much indefensible, so I can't say, oh, it's cool because it's Katie Royfe. You can totally be sexist. But I also feel like she has to take responsibility for the fact that it's like, it's not just because she, as a woman, is writing these things. It's because she's writing incredibly wrong-headed, offensive, and completely tone-deaf pieces that she's getting this kind of reaction.
Sorry. I was thinking about Ho Chi Minh reading
Sight. I was thinking about Dallas.
Well, on that note, let's talk about our faves. Sherston's fave, Siri mispronouncing doulas.
I've been watching Twin Peaks on Netflix Instant, and I've never seen it before, but it's really great for the wintertime. So if you have Netflix Instant and you've been meaning to watch Twin Peaks, this is the year to do it. I'm just saying.
And did you want to share your thoughts about Twin Peaks versus The Killing now that you've seen it?
No, I won't.
She had some thoughts. Maybe they'll be shared at a later date.
I just don't get why The Killing even tried. Like, maybe someone can clear that up for me.
Someone already did this one murder series.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, do you have a fave to share with us?
Well, yeah, since we were talking about lifestyle blogs before, and I like to support lifestyle magazines, and there's a couple that I really like. And I feel like maybe I've talked about this before, but I really don't care because I'm going to talk about it again. Uppercase Magazine out of Canada is really great. It's really beautiful production values. They come out 4 times a year, just like Bitch. And it's a really lovely magazine about sort of the creative lifestyle. And it, you know, there's art, there's design, there's typography, there's, you know, people who make furniture, there's people who are like really into food, and it's delightful, and I like to support any small magazine that's out there trying to make it work. So I think their website is uppercase.ca.
Sounds awesome. All right, well, I kind of have two. They're both holiday related. The first is the AV Club Holiday Undercover series, where every holiday season, or at least starting last year, the second annual, the AV Club runs a series of bands covering holiday music classics once a week, and it's really fun. Already this season, they've had Electric Six covering You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch, and Peter Wolfcryer covering Last Christmas by Wham, which is a song that is very polarizing, but I love it.
It's amazing.
And
it's not polarizing here.
Not polarizing
among
us.
Not among these two people.
Among the rest of the office it is, but just wait until we get a Bitch karaoke time where I can perform it, because that's going to change people's minds. But it's really fun, especially if you're like me and you love holiday music and aren't ashamed, because it's a way to kind of get a little street cred while actually just listening to holiday music, because it's cool bands, but... and I will just re-plug, last year they had the Walkman covering Holiday Road, which is just like an instant Christmas classic for me now. So check that out. And then also I just wanted to plug very quickly the Bitch in a Box Holiday Gift Guide. They were just really fun. Different people in the office are taking different themes and posting gift guides on our website. And I love to see what everybody comes up with. I'm already... trying to figure out who can buy me those animal-shaped soy sauce containers that Julie blogged about yesterday. And we have a lot of fun ones coming up. A calendar edition, a tea lover's edition. So if you're looking for shopping tips, check it out because they're really fun. All right, well, thank you for recording Papaganda. Thank you for listening. You can find more of our audio offerings at bitchmedia.org/audio.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart.
Thanks for tuning in. You can find links to the topics we discussed in this episode at our website, bitchmedia.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Please email radio@b-word.org with your feedback. Remember, Bitch Media is a nonprofit organization, and we rely on your support. Please visit bitchmedia.org/donate to find out how you can get more involved.
I'll give it to someone special.